or two for you to talk to us about what you where you think things are going. I really appreciate what you do, and more people to know need to know about it. So, what is happening, and what do you feel is first and second?
Well, thank you for that, and I'd be happy to join you whenever you want, because there are developments, and I think starting with the 28 pages is a good way to get into the overall strategic crisis which we face, which is an extremely acute crisis. Let me tell you, first of all, that there are two additional signers now in the House of Representatives on H.Res. 14, which is the bill that was introduced by Walter Jones, a Republican from North Carolina, Massey, a Republican from Kentucky, and Stephen Lynch, a Democrat from Massachusetts, which calls on the president to declassify the chapter in the original congressional 9/11 report, which deals with the Saudi role in 9/11. Now, this is a special interest for people in your area, given that there is a whole treasure trove of documents that the FBI has that took about 10 years or 12 years to force the FBI to release them, but about networks in the Sarasota area which were funded by the Saudis that were involved in 9/11. Now, the reason this is so important is that there was a press conference on January 7th in Washington, D.C., by Walter Jones and Stephen Lynch and their special guest, former Florida Senator Bob Graham, who is really at the center of the insistence that this declassification occur. And what had happened, you may remember, January 7th was the day of the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris. And what Senator Graham said in his opening remarks is people are asking, why have you continued to pursue this story after 12 years? What's the big deal? And Graham said the consequences of what we've covered up on behind 9/11 are seen in the day-to-day struggle against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. But secondly, what happened in Paris? Because as it's turned out, the two shooters at the Charlie Hebdo case were recruited by an imam in a Saudi mosque, Finsbury Park Mosque, in London, an imam named Abu Hamza, who's been protected by the British government as part of their relationship with the Saudi government.
Now, let me stop you there a second. That who's been stopped by the British government in order to not to offend the Saudis, has been the nature of the history of this whole thing. If the Saudis get upset, the world shakes. What the devil's going on there?
Well, it's actually a little bit more complicated than that, because the key role of the British and the Saudis is that the Saudi regime that's in power, the regime of former tribal leader Ibn Saud, was put in power by the British in the period during World War I, when the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, which controlled most of the Middle East, collapsed. And the British, out of their offices in Egypt, the Cairo Arab Bureau, were recruiting various leaders for the post-war world to be operatives for the British Empire. It was partly about oil, but more than that, it was about the Arabian Peninsula and that area as a bridge between Asia and Africa. And the British imperial interests demanded that they have governments that were friendly to them. And so you had on the western side of the Arabian Peninsula, you had Lawrence of Arabia, who became famous because of the movie. He was trying to ensure that the Hussein family, which had been the guardians of Mecca and Medina since the time of the Prophet Muhammad, would be the ones who would rule the Arabian Peninsula. But another group of British operatives chose the Saud family, which was a fairly barbaric, brutal desert tribe. And instead, they took the Hussein family and put them into Jordan. That's where the current king of Jordan, Abdullah, comes from, the family that the British put in Jordan. But the power in Saudi Arabia was given to the Saud family, and King Salman, who just was recently came to power there, is the last direct descendant in the lineage of King Ibn Saud, who founded the dynasty. Now, the important thing here is what does London gain from this? Why are the British, and of course President Obama as well, so insistent that the Saudis are our friends when the Saudi regime is one of the most barbaric regimes, they do beheadings. They don't allow women to drive. They don't allow women to appear in public without their husbands. But more importantly, they've been financing the jihadi movement through their what's called the Wahhabite strain of Islam. And the Wahhabite goes back to Wahhabi in the 18th century, an extreme fundamentalist. And this is the what was adopted by the Saud tribe as their view of Islam. And in their view, if you are not a total believer in the Wahhabite view of Islam, then you're an infidel and you should be killed. And they're the ones who are funding, not only going back, this goes back to the 1980s in Afghanistan, and Osama bin Laden. Remember, he was a Saudi. Osama bin Laden's father was the contractor, the building contractor for the Saudi monarchy.
You know, the thing that's interesting here, among other things, of course, is the teaching of that religion, if you will, because they capture Mecca, the homeland, the place that everybody goes to honor Islam, and they pervert it, and they've been doing it for so long, and the effect on the world is these ISIS and Al Qaeda and whatever new thing comes up in order to reestablish a caliphate or whatever purpose they have. And now the killing and shooting or attempted killing of Vilks, the cartoonist in Denmark, just yesterday, I guess.
Right.
So you have this continuum, and the fear it's placed in the West over where is it going to pop up next, like a mushroom. You know, this thing is for a small number of people in their power, and to know they have the money behind them.
But Augie, that's the key thing, the money. Because the Wahhabite religion was there for a longer period of time, but it was somewhat restricted to this nomadic tribe in the desert. Once they got control of the oil fields and the oil, and that was done largely through an agreement with between British Petroleum and a couple of American firms, Standard Oil, that initially put them in the driver's seat. And to this day, the oil is still plentiful there, and it's very cheap to take out of the ground. That's why the Saudis don't mind having the oil price fall. But the important thing is that because they have the money, they are the ideal operation for funding this global jihadist network. Now, that brings us to the question of why do the British and why does President Obama continue to rely on them and support them? And this is where you see the old imperial geopolitics rear its ugly head. Because this is really not about anything to do with Saudi Arabia or even Syria or Iran or Iraq. This is part of the post-Cold War struggle of the British Empire with the City of London and Wall Street together trying to impose a globalized banker's dictatorship which would allow no other country to have independent financial operations. And the Russians and the Chinese refused to go along with this. And a lot of what we're seeing with this expansion of terrorism is part of the old Zbigniew Brzezinski plan of surrounding Russia with Islamic fundamentalists. And it's worth noting that the Chechnya operation inside Russia, which is funded and orchestrated out of London, is providing 40% of the leaders of ISIS are Chechen Islamic rebels.
So here you have Saudi indirectly through this bank doing the dirt. I mean, it's just...
Well, and that's what Bob Graham brought up, and he said it's in the 9/11 report, but he can't tell you what the details are because it's classified.
Well,
and so...
You know, on that point, I've been talking to my granddaughter, who's a writer, and I told her the situation, and she's very bright, very informed, so I thought, or so she thought, until she read this. And why would it hurt us to know that Saudi Arabia it can be concluded, a substantial financial supporter of the 9/11 was a substantial supporter of the 9/11 attacks. It isn't exactly hard to find out that 15 of the 19 terrorists involved in the attack were Saudi Arabian. Now, this is a young person, and she's very smart, very typical, but unaware. And here she wants to go read some of this stuff. But if you repeat it or you reveal it in some way, you're under threat of violating the law and a contempt of Congress or whatever.
Well, and that's why it's so important what Graham and people like Stephen Lynch and Walter Jones are doing, because here's what Graham said in that press conference in Washington. He said, the Saudis know what they did, and they know that the U.S. government knows what they did. So the fact that the U.S. government, first Bush and now Obama, are keeping these documents classified convinces the Saudis that it's okay to keep doing it. And so this is a really important point, because if people knew that the terrorist operation in the Middle East is not just something that's homegrown, that sprang out of Islam like mushrooms in a manure field, but was actually a coordinated, organized force, then we would be able to competently combat it. But what the president did last week, and this is sort of what we're leading to, he said, now we're going to fight ISIL, we're going to degrade them, we're going to destroy them. Well, you want to destroy them? Cut off their funds. Shut down the Saudi monarchy's network of financing of these terrorists, and identify the Saudis and force the Saudis to come out and actually fight them.
Okay, well, here's the situation. The Saudis are largely Sunni, and the ISIS, there's a lot of Shiites in the ISIS, and I think the administration feels that we have this kind of stalemate almost between the Sunnis and the Shiites, which have had for over 1,000 years this animosity between themselves. And if we alienate the Saudis, we can unite these two brands of Islam, radical Islam. And isn't that a fear that we have right now, to alienate the Saudis and have this unification?
Well, it's a little bit different, because the ISIS are Sunnis also. The ISIS organization comes out of the Sunni networks in Iraq, which formed al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a Sunni operation. And the Shiites are fighting ISIS. The Iranians are joining with the Assad regime to fight against ISIS. So what the administration initially had this formulation, and you're right about this, that they would defend the Sunnis against the Shia. Although if you go back to the 80s, and that's why the 80s are so important, you remember the Iran-Iraq war? Funny. Initially, the United States supported Saddam Hussein in that war. Saddam was essentially a Sunni regime in a country that was over 50% Shiite. And there was genocide committed against the Shiites, and then Oliver North went to Tehran, and the United States shifted sides and started supporting the Shiites. So it's a very complicated thing, but essentially the idea is, if you can keep these groups fighting, then you can keep control over them. That's the old British Empire's divide and conquer strategy, which they learned from the Romans.
And the Iraq-Iran war cost over 1 million lives of soldiers between those two countries, and we were supplying
exactly
the arms to Saddam Hussein to kill the Iranians as a consequence of a number of different things that we were involved
with. And then we switched sides. But
right.
Then you add in what happened in Afghanistan, where the United States and the British imported, with money from bin Laden, Sunni radicals from all over the Middle East into Afghanistan, where the U.S. and the British trained them in Pakistan, and this was to drive out the pro-Soviet government and the Russian troops that were in Afghanistan. So we brought the Taliban and al-Qaeda networks into Afghanistan, put them in power, and then left. And that's what was the germinating point of the 9/11, the so-called al-Qaeda presence inside, protected in Afghanistan. That's why we went to war with Afghanistan after 9/11. Iraq had nothing to do with it. And this was where Tony Blair convinced Bush that we need to go into Iraq because Saddam runs international terrorism and Saddam is about to develop weapons of mass destruction, which he'll give to the al-Qaeda networks, all of which turned out to be a bunch of lies.
You know, just a few days ago, the Ayatollah of Iran offered to fight against ISIS, because, you know, and of course, immediately the conservatives came forward and said, oh, we can't do that. My gosh, you know, we're going to upset Saudi and we're going to lose the friendship of the people we need. And the ironic, I mean, the thing of pitting groups with a similar goal in life to survive, one against the other, the poor against the poor, very often the ignorant against the ignorant.
Yeah.
This is the old Southern plantation routine that was done, poor whites against blacks. It's a tactic that power uses all the time, and the people, unfortunately, are unaware that that's going on until the plight gets so great that they flee out of sheer terror, and that's what we've got.
Well, Augie, if you look at the background to this, if you look at what Saddam Hussein really was, what Assad represents, they're trying in a very difficult situation where you have warring tribes, and sometimes even you have Sunni tribes that fight each other and Shia tribes that fight each other, because they tend to have local alliances and family loyalty. So you look at this and you see that what Saddam had to do in order to keep Iraq relatively stable was have an agreement between the various groups that he would share the oil revenues with them, and in return they wouldn't fight. And if they did fight, he went in and suppressed it ruthlessly. Same thing with Assad, same thing with Gaddafi. Now, these weren't good people, but what they were trying to do was keep peace in a relatively bad part of the world. And what they did do in Syria and Iraq was they promoted women. You had women who were university professors and in government and doctors and scientists, whereas in Saudi Arabia and the fundamentalist countries, Kuwait and Abu Dhabi and others, women really are not given any freedom at all. Now, what's interesting is that when you go in and overthrow those dictators, what do? You unleash all the rival groups that have access to the arms that we provided those governments. And you look at Libya right now, where we knocked out Gaddafi in what was an unconstitutional war policy of the president. And he was allowed to do it because McCain and John Kerry in the Senate suppressed a revolt that was demanding that Obama come to the Congress before he deploy U.S. forces against Gaddafi. Now Gaddafi's gone, and you have al-Qaeda linked to ISIS taking over whole parts of northern Libya now. And this is what Benghazi was about. The Libyan forces that overthrew Gaddafi were sending U.S. weapons to the so-called rebels in Syria. And who are the leading rebels in Syria? The people who became ISIS and al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda and the ISIS groups inside Syria and Iraq. So our government, because we haven't really exposed the alliance we've had with the Saudis for what it is responsible for arming and in some cases even training what are becoming the terrorist networks that the president now says we have to fight in the Middle East.
We're going to be coming to a short break, Harley. We've got to announce an unfortunate situation that has happened to one of our broadcasters here, and we'll be breaking in about a couple of minutes. So, but we're going to come back and continue.
Yeah, please hold and please stay with us, okay? We're talking to
Harley Schlanger from the LaRouche PAC. Is that right, Harley? Do you want to give us the right and who to contact and what to do?
Yes, the best thing to do is you can go on LaRouchePAC.com, which is LaRouchePAC.com, or you can call us, and it's a toll-free number. If you want more information or if you want to speak with me, you can call this number. It's 800-929-7566. So it's a toll-free call for you, 800-929-7566.
Well, that's great, Harley. We're going to be breaking now, and we'll just stay on hold, and we'll come right back to you after this. So, in any event, Rick on the radio, all of you faithful listeners to 1490 AM, you know Rick has been a broadcaster here, and some of you know that he's fallen ill, and as of yesterday, Rick expired and passed away. So we will dearly miss Rick and his gravelly, sarcastic, wonderful voice. Not quite at the level of Jon Stewart in terms of sardonic humor, but right up there with the people who think along that line of, isn't it ironic that our president does the favor of the oil interests and at the same time tries to do some other good things. And where do we stand as a people? Do we speak out about it? Well, Rick would have done that, and that's the point. We've got 1490, Bud Beck, and all the other past hosts, Henry Raines and so forth, a chorus of people who had a voice for the underdog and for social justice, and let the money be spent here, rain on the parade of the wealthy, make them uncomfortable, and comfort the afflicted. So here we are, and hats off to Rick, and what thoughts do you have, Floyd?
Yeah, Rick was a remarkable individual. I've worked with him and listened to him and had him over at my house, and I'm going to miss him dearly. And hopefully Rick on the other side will be giving them his peace of mind and letting them know what he thinks.
If high up matters at all, maybe he'll help our ratings.
Yes. So hats off to Rick, and we're going to miss you dearly.
Well, coming back to Harley Slanger. Harley, are you still on the line?
Yes.
Okay. This whole business of pitting weak against weak, poor against poor, and maintaining the lower education through using religion as the escape place for calling it education, but it's really indoctrination. And it's what cultures will do when they really don't give a damn about the poor. And slavery is the next step, and that's what we did in the South for the longest time, and we made fear the factor. When the Cubans started coming into Miami, the fear was among blacks that the Cubans were going to replace you, and of course right away the wealthy started replacing the blacks in their jobs, and that is as continuous among the conservative corporate interests in this country. So here you have this alliance of corporatism. I guess that's the best way to put it. And yeah, what you're talking about and the issue of the purpose of bringing down the wall in Russia was to allow countries to act like Western Europe. NATO was there always as a protection, a uniter, supposedly, but it's become a question, is NATO being used to threaten Russia to not bring them into NATO? And using the Ukraine has always been a problem for Russia. It was a grain belt for years, and now it's the issue of the bridge to Crimea, and whether or not the government of Ukraine at Kiev is going to be a democracy and tie into Europe at the threat of Russia or not, and the business of calling people that you disagree with on that side Nazis, which is what has been coming out of Putin's mouth, and Merkel has been saying that Putin's been a liar, which has been, but Obama's leaving her deciding what's going to happen, pretty much so, being the leader of Europe. It makes some sense, but he stood back on that. So where does that come down, Harley?
Well, actually, Merkel has changed her opinion in the last couple of weeks, which is why she did that 16-hour meeting with France's President Hollande, Ukraine's Poroshenko, and Putin. But let's go back a step on this, because look, the important thing is that NATO existed for what purpose? To prevent the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact military alliance from overrunning Western Europe. When communism collapsed with the Gorbachev regime in Russia, there was an agreement made first from the Reagan administration, then the Bush administration, followed up by Clinton and Bush Jr., that there would be no NATO expansion eastward if the Russians withdrew their military forces from Eastern Europe. Now, just last Friday, Jack Matlock, who was Reagan's ambassador to Russia, from appointed in 1987, and he served until 91, gave a strong attack against the Obama administration for its policy there, because what Matlock said is that we promised the Russians we would not expand NATO. Now, the argument is that NATO is expanding because of Russian expansionism. But if you look at what happened, last February, an agreement was reached in which there would be new elections in Ukraine, that Yanukovych would stay in office until those new elections took place. And within 2 days after that February 21st agreement, Yanukovych was sent fleeing by armed gangs in the Maidan Square in Kiev. And at that point, the new government that came in was the government that was selected by NATO and the United States. Our ambassador to Kiev and the Deputy Secretary of State for Europe, Victoria Nuland, were caught on the phone talking about how they were going to put Yatsenyuk, who was an anti-Russian, into power in Kiev. And that became a very big scandal, at least initially. Now, the Russians reacted to that because they saw the danger that NATO forces would be put on the doorstep of Russia. And so the second thing they reacted to was a law that was passed by the new Kiev government that outlawed the speaking of Russian among Russian-speaking Ukrainians in eastern Ukraine. And that's when the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk rebels took up arms against the government because they were afraid that they were going to be under attack, in particular by right-wing networks that came into power in Kiev under the Svoboda Party and the Right Sector. These are two parties that in 2011 were condemned by the European Union as having Nazi views and anti-Semitic and anti-Russian and anti-Polish views. After the coup in February, the European Union, NATO, and the United States supported those groups which they had condemned as Nazis 3 years earlier. And so I think what we have to do in looking at this is realize that there's been a demonization of Russia. For what reason? Because Putin refused to have Russia back up the European Union. Putin was asked to use Russia's oil wealth to buy Eurobonds to help with the crisis in Greece and Spain and Portugal, because they were the only other option was a bailout, quantitative easing. And Putin and the Chinese said no. And at that point, the operation was set in motion to have regime change in Russia. And what Matlock, again, the former U.S. ambassador to Russia, who was an ambassador under Reagan and Bush Sr., what Matlock said is that the way we're pushing Russia right now risks engaging the U.S. and Russia in a nuclear war. Now, that's why Merkel came to talk to Obama and said, don't send weapons to Ukraine because it will just encourage them to keep fighting. And so she and Hollande and Poroshenko met with Putin last week in Minsk and crafted the ceasefire. Now, the two groups that didn't fully agree with the ceasefire were the right-wing brigades that make up the majority of the Ukrainian forces in eastern Ukraine, the so-called Azov Brigade, which has as its symbol a knockoff of the Nazi swastika. And then the pro-Russian rebels are saying they're not going to put down their arms. So this is an extremely fragile ceasefire. But I think the attempt to blame it on Putin is rewriting history. And in fact, the irony is that Victoria Nuland, who's shaping U.S. policy, under President Obama, her husband is Robert Kagan, one of the most significant neocons in shaping the Bush war policy under George W. Bush. And Nuland is tied to Wolfowitz, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the other neocons who are the ones, the architects of the Iraq war.
Yeah,
so this is a horrible situation we're in.
Well, the outcome, you know, the cost in pride is one thing, that is to reveal the connections between the Saudis and how they escaped and so forth, and what that turned into, these three wars. I say three wars because now we're in the third one with the ISIS, the furthering of the whole thing.
Right. Right.
So we are already there. And now the possible of a fourth war, so to speak, using this division within the Ukraine. Ukraine has always been a problem for Russia, as I mentioned earlier, because of the grain and the breadbasket and what Stalin did back in the 30s and starving them, taking away
right.
the grain and all. But you have a history that is fraught with conflict between Ukraine and Russia. So we know that. That is the United States leadership.
Well, and that's why you have to negotiate. And the fact that the U.S. is simply blaming Putin rather than talking with him, according to today's Der Spiegel, which is the leading sort of unofficial government magazine of Germany, that during the last hours of the summit which led to the agreement, Putin called the leaders of eastern Ukraine and threatened them that if they didn't put down their weapons, that the Russians would take action against them. And that goes against the lie that Putin is pushing them for the idea of expanding Russia. Now, Augie, you're absolutely right about what Stalin did in Ukraine and the fact that you have this history. And don't forget also, in Western Ukraine, and this is where the other problem comes in, people like Stefan Bandera, who was a leader in Ukraine, joined the Nazi SS when the Germans invaded Ukraine as they were marching toward Russia. And so you had that real split between Stalin, communism, and Hitler's Nazis. Now, the other problem with Ukraine is it's bankrupt. And Putin doesn't really want to take over Ukraine because he doesn't want to have to spend huge amounts of money.
They would be a welfare state if he did that. And
exactly. And
they've already got a huge, I mean, their infrastructure, their wells is so bad they don't have the money themselves to reinvigorate their own oil production.
Well, and the problem is that the Saudis are conducting a form of financial warfare against Iran and Russia by pushing the price of oil down, and there's an unintended consequence of that, which is it's also hitting the U.S. oil sector in a very interesting way, because I'm here in Texas, and I see this every single day. We're starting to see bankruptcies in the oil business because much of the fracking was financed with the expectation that oil would remain at about $80 or $90 a barrel. And so there was huge amounts of borrowing in order to produce the oil. Now what happened is that borrowing was then turned into a derivative. It was securitized and turned into
chop,
a derivative.
Chop. Yeah, chop, chop, chop.
Yes, and now it's just like the mortgage business, that the people don't have the money to pay the loans back. And so we're not just going to see bankruptcy of oil companies, but a possible effect of a $1.3 to $2 trillion hole knocked out of the economy. And I don't know if you know this, Augie, but last December, one of the last acts of the Congress was to repeal a provision in the Dodd-Frank bill,
yep,
which said that commodity derivatives are not covered by the FDIC.
Meaning
they repealed that.
Yeah, it falls on everybody. Wow.
Yeah. Exactly.
You just go, keep going. I mean,
what that means is that by an act of the Congress, which was supported by Boehner, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase was personally involved in lobbying to repeal this provision, and so did President Barack Obama. Yes. And this was included in the so-called Cromnibus budget bill, which means that the American taxpayer, because the FDIC doesn't have $1.3 trillion, the American taxpayer through the U.S. Treasury will be bailing out commercial banks again if these oil derivatives blow. And from a report from the Dallas Federal Reserve last week, we're very close to seeing a chain reaction collapse of this derivative market because of the collapse of the price of oil. So while the Saudis are being used to conduct economic warfare against Russia and Iran, it also inadvertently threatens the U.S. banking system because we're still dependent for the too big to fail banks on the financial speculation in these so-called financial innovative papers, the derivatives, options, swaptions, and so on.
It's the new bubble. And if it bursts, we're in trouble. But the real fact is, notice the price of gas going up, and that's going to be subtly rising all back up again. And to get it to a level where those people don't go out of business and those derivatives don't kick in the way they can.
Well, they're trying to do that, and it brings up an interesting question, which is that since the oil production is still a surplus of what's needed, what happened to the argument that it's the free market that sets the prices?
Oh, well, the joke's on us. I mean, it's capitalism that's gone nuts. And
well, one of my colleagues, someone I speak with quite often, the former chief economist of the Bank for International Settlements, said that what we're seeing is one bubble after another, and sooner or later, in order to keep building up these bubbles, which, by the way, is what the president is talking about when he says we have an economic recovery, it's the stock market bubble. It's not a real economic recovery. He said sooner or later, we're going to have a hyperinflationary collapse because all this money that's being pumped is going to be called on to bail out the system. Right now it's sitting in the books of banks and in the form of treasuries and the Federal Reserve. If those have to be monetized, that is, put into the economy, we're going to have a hyperinflation. And the banks don't mind that because that means they can pay off their debts
with
cheaper
money.
Dollars.
Yeah, exactly.
But it means you and I and everyone else won't be able to afford to eat or pay our rent or our utilities.
No, it could fall at the right time or the wrong time depending on how you look at politics. But it's a huge, huge issue.
And we have coverage of this again on our website at LaRouchePac.com. If you go to that, it's LaRouchePac.com. You can see articles on the derivatives bubble, the war danger, and also the solution to it. Because, you know, what we have to do, and there are two things that I think are important. I just want to get this out now, and then we can continue.
I don't like it when people just cite problem upon problem and don't offer a solution. So, I mean, I want the cap off of Social Security, all dollars taxed the same. And where are you going with this?
Well, there are two things. The first thing is, in terms of the strategic situation, we have to get these 28 pages out so that the American people can be brought into a debate. As long as there's a cover-up, then we're debating without knowledge.
Harvey,
and that's how we got into the Iraq War.
If I may, let's play the devil's advocate for a moment. We know the government is reluctant to release those 28 pages. What would be the worst scenario if they did? If they did release it, and it does implicate Saudi Arabia, which all three of us believe will happen, what will be the worst scenario if Saudi Arabia is implicated and the American public and the world knows how they were involved in 9/11?
I don't think there's a worst scenario, because my view is that getting to the truth is the basis for having a competent discussion of what the policy should be. And as I said, Floyd, we're debating in the dark right now. When the president issues his proposal for an authorization for the use of military force, and the Congress is split with Republicans saying it's too restrictive and the Democrats correctly saying that it's an open invitation to an endless war, but they're not getting at the real question of who's the enemy? Are we really fighting
here? I understand that, but if Saudi Arabia, as we're aware of, 15 of the hijackers came from oil-rich, Bush-friendly Saudi Arabia, if they're already supporting our enemies, if we push them over the edge and they give 100% support to our enemies, does that make the situation worse? Right now,
no, because I think that what we could do, how would we contain Saudi Arabia? One of the things we would do is stop laundering their money, stop letting them put their money in Western banks. We could cut off the funds and then say to the Saudis, either you work with us on this, because there are people in Saudi Arabia who don't want, they have a jihad problem in their own country that's starting to develop.
I think that's what I think would unleash is the jihad right there, because it would discredit their relationship to the United States in such a way that the West is already being blamed. Here you got a complicity.
And that's the danger. But the way either you risk having a collapse in the chaos, or you have an organized change.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we have to do is sit down with our real allies, and that would be in this case Russia, China, the European nations. Stop trying to overthrow Assad, and because he's one of the few people who's actually fighting the terrorists in that area. Stop the anti-Iran, and just say to Iran, you stay out of this situation, but we need your help in Iraq.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have to ask our alleged enemies, Russia, Syria, and Iran, to help us out of this mess. And it's
exactly.
And it's
the
like
question is, are they really our enemies?
Yeah.
And then Iran is really not our enemy. And 2 years ago, the CIA apologized for 1953 when we shut down their government under the Eisenhower administration and the Dulles brothers.
So I think that Floyd, in answer to that, there's always a danger if you change the status quo, but the status quo is leading us toward World War III. So I think we have to get the serious thinkers, including, the U.S. military is not happy with our policy in the region because they know it's tending toward an endless war. Now, let me just address the second question, the solution, because the 28 pages is a starting step toward changing foreign policy and shedding light on who are our real friends and who are our real enemies. The second step is we've got to end the bailout regime where we protect the too big to fail banks against the funding of the real economy. And something just came up the other day, you may have seen this, a new report on Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation, where they have, they're aiding 2,000 billionaire tax evaders. At the same time, they're continuing to launder drug money and money to terrorists. This is a bank that's been fined repeatedly, but has been protected by the Justice Department. It should have its charter revoked and should be shut down as a terrorist bank. Now, if we go with their four proposals, laws that, that LaRouche has proposed, that are simple ones. Number one, Glass-Steagall.
We need to go back to Glass-Steagall and retire Dodd-Frank entirely, stop giving
exactly.
them excuses. Yeah.
And that way we protect the commercial banking system to do what it's supposed to do, which is make loans for commerce and protect people's savings and deposits, instead of allowing them to use that as a base for speculation to put Uncle Sam on the hook through the FDIC and the Treasury. So the investment banks will have to fend for themselves, but they'll be cut off from the flow of funds that are protecting commercial banks. So no more bailouts. Then secondly, we need to have credit.
Harley, let me stop you there a second.
Yeah.
You mentioned the London banks and the relationship to Saudi. When the Brits realize what has happened and what the Saudis have done, and they're going to look at their banks, and they're going to lead the way in doing what you're talking about. I really believe the Brits will do that. We'll have the harder time because we're invested in war, and golly gee, isn't this fun? So go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, and the other thing is that the Brits are having to deal with this problem with Greece, which, you know, Greece represents 3% of the Eurozone, which you would think isn't such a big problem. The reason it's a big problem is if Greece can force a shift away from killing their country to collect debt, then why would Spain, Italy, and Portugal, which represent collectively over 20% of the Eurozone, why would they continue the policies that aren't working? And that immediately threatens the German banks, the French banks, the Spanish banks, and the British banks. So there's rethinking going on, because in the midst of this now, Europe is being hit by the effects of sanctions against Russia on top of that. That's why I think Merkel and Hollande went to negotiate with Putin.
So these are not the Chamberlains of the past, Merkel and Hollande. This is being alleged by the conservatives.
No, they're not the Chamberlains, because what they're... First of all, Putin is not Hitler, but despite what John McCain might think. But secondly, they're looking at a situation, you know, we had the 100th year anniversary of World War I, and there was a very prominent book written by a historian named Clark called Sleepwalking into War. And it's a very detailed report on how step by step from 1890 forward, all the protections against war were knocked down. So in the end, when troops mobilized after the assassination of the Habsburg Archduke, war was inevitable. And what many people are saying today is we're sleepwalking into World War III, which could be a nuclear war. So Merkel and Hollande and Putin, and to some extent Poroshenko, finally said, let's stop sleepwalking and figure out how we can reverse this process. And we're not there yet. It's still very dangerous. And the biggest problem is that President Obama, in terms of his foreign policy, through people like Samantha Power, the UN ambassador, and Susan Rice, the national security advisor, they believe in this idea of regime change, and that idea of regime change is sort of the liberal version of the imperial policy of the neocons. And so we have the same policy under Obama that we had under Bush Jr.
So here comes Roger Altman, and there was a discussion on CNBC last week, I believe, early part. And he stated flatly that the sanctions are not, if you're going to control Putin, you've got to raise the sanction level. So depending on who you raise the sanction levels against, you have a certain kind of an outcome. I mean, if you do it in the wrong place, you do further sleepwalking.
Well, Augie, let me just throw something out to you. I'd like your thinking on this. Sanctions are, in a sense, an act of war.
Sure they
we're
are.
Saying we're trying to punish the Russian people and bring them into an agreement with us by using methods of war by other means. And the American media is cheerleading economic problems in Russia, which means 140 million people are going to suffer because of the policies of our government. How does that build trust? How does that create a basis for avoiding war. It doesn't.
Well, when they do, as you say, the Russians are suffering. our gas prices are going down. Isn't that wonderful? Which is what the consequent thought is on the street. And by the way, Iran is really an enemy. No, they're not, in my opinion, at all. And when the Ayatollah comes out and says, we will help you fight ISIS, in other words, the Ayatollah, I believe now, is afraid that the one that's going to back away from the Iranian nuclear deal is going to be the United States. So they want it, or they wouldn't.
You want to know something interesting? You brought up earlier that in these poorer countries, you pit the poor against the poor,
right,
that using religion, using tribal loyalties, and so on. Look what we're doing in the United States. We're miseducating the population. The mainstream media is lying about these things. Both political parties are controlled by the Wall Street interests that Eisenhower identified as the military-industrial complex that want wars. And the average American is being yanked and pulled between liberals and conservatives on social issues, taxation, things of that sort. Meanwhile, the standard of living in the United States as a whole is declining because of the policies of Wall Street, and most Americans are blaming either the Republicans or the Democrats, depending on whether they listen to CNN or Fox. So our own country is divided around this destruction of education, so there's not enough critical thinking. That's why I think it's so important that Bob Graham's initiative be carried through, because what Graham said at the end of his press conference is we should never fear the truth, because the truth is the basis for making policy. What's the statement, the truth shall set you free?
Yep.
I mean, this is really the problem in our country. Truth has become a matter of whose opinion you accept, as opposed to looking for the actual processes which enable you to know something.
For a good result, the truth matters. Which truth is what we're talking about, and who it matters to the most. And the walking on the bones of the poor, the crunching sound under your feet, so what? It's the poor. We don't care. We don't give a damn.
And, you know, there's an old Yiddish proverb which says, the truth never dies, but it lives a miserable life.
Yeah.
You know, I think we have to free the truth from that misery and actually get to the point where we can start trusting our political leaders.
Well, speaking of leaders, and you keep mentioning Bob Graham, but the penalty for revealing what they've read is what? A congressional hearing against them for violating?
Oh, no, it's jail. Releasing classified information can end you up in jail, which is one of the reasons Obama is prosecuting all these whistleblowers.
So he would have to prosecute Bob Graham if he decides to reveal this.
And that's why he hasn't.
Mm-hmm. But
he's using the issue as a basis of trying to change the direction of foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's any brave souls out there that have read these documents that will actually put themselves on the line for having read it and say, this is what I read, period.
Well, you know, one who might be has been denied the right to read it, namely Representative Grayson from Florida has been refused the right to read it. He's the only one so far who requested and wasn't allowed to.
Up front they denied him?
Yes.
Wow. Wow.
And the reason is they say they have to do more security clearance on him. You know, to read the report, you cannot have an aide, you cannot take notes, you have two people sitting over your shoulders while you're reading it. And so to read the 28 pages is actually somewhat of an ordeal for a congressman, but in the case of Grayson, they won't even let him read it.
Well, they're afraid that he's got a memory that can... Well, all you'd have to do is to take some key points and say, well, this is the money, this is the amount, this is what this went where, and you don't have that many points. And I read it. I went through and read it. You can just state that you read it. Slap the cuffs on me. Treat me like we do, what's his name, the whistleblower on...
Snowden?
Snowden, yeah.
I mean, well, Snowden, and remember, this is the same thing that Daniel Ellsberg did in the 1970s with the Pentagon Papers, where he released documents showing that the Pentagon believed there was no way to win the Vietnam War, while our presidents were telling us we've got to keep fighting, and the military was saying we've got to keep fighting. So, you know, we've had a history of this kind of classification, and Ellsberg risked going to prison, and he eventually won his case. Snowden, I think, is right in saying he's not going to come back because there's no way he could get a fair trial. So we're in a situation where you do need some very courageous people, And we need the population to call their congressman to demand that HRES 14 be passed, that we get this declassified, we get the information out to the public. Graham has said, as someone who's read it and as someone who was the chairman of the Intelligence Committee for a number of years, there's nothing in here that being released would threaten U.S. security. He said it would make us stronger.
Well, how can we make a movement to get that released, to have more people aware of it? Do you have any suggestions?
Well, I think it's starting to happen because there are now newspapers that are writing op-eds on it. There are newspaper editorials. We're beginning to get, I think we're now at 14 congressmen who have signed on to this resolution. So things like your program help. But your listeners really should make sure that the congressman in your area and your listening audience join this movement. And that means the American people are going to have to become a part of the solution.
Now, I have to warn you, you're going to go off the air in about 30 seconds. So if you can finish up, Augie and Harvey.
Well, we've done.
Well, here's the number to call, 800-929-7566. If you want to become part of this fight, 800-929-7566.
And Harley, I want you back next month. And we'll set up a time and the issues at hand and the progress on go to jail and reveal the truth or whatever.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you, Harley.
Sure. Bye. Bye.
Okay.
Well, we can go to the end of the show, or we can make further commentary, but we've got down to about a minute or so.
We're almost done right now. That was a wonderful conversation. Very well-informed guest, and I'm really pleased to have had a chance, just as a knowledgeable listener, to gain some better insight into what's happening in America.
Well, this LaRouche group is impressive, and we're going to have more of that. So thank you so much. We'll see you on Wednesday. And cheerio. What's our theme song going to say?
Folks, when Chris Polino says that normal operations have resumed at Dulles International Airport after some earlier delay.
Last night around 10:30 p.m., a water pipe burst in the tower, which triggered an alarm, causing an evacuation of the FAA tower. It caused a change in flight operations. We had limited arrivals and no departures for a brief period of time.
Strong winds expected to continue in New England today, with possibly another storm on the way there.